Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We are living through extreme times. A new dire threat seemingly every month. The heat waves and the active shooters, one new COVID strain after another, each more infectious than the last. Now we got monkeypox. As our editor Karen Froman put it in a meeting recently, it feels like we're all being constantly chased. But truthfully, some communities have faced this kind of strain before. Some of us have faced down the worst case scenario and even amid horror, found ways to maintain the little joys that a lot of times we fought hard to get in the first place. Karen has actually seen this up close herself. She was here in New York in the early days of the HIV epidemic in the 80s, at a time when a diagnosis with this mysterious illness was essentially a death sentence, one often handed down to young people in the prime of their lives.
Well, I volunteered for a small agency to go in and to clean and to bring food. And so I remember going and meeting this young man. His name was John. And when I first started to care for him, I felt like I was taking care of someone my brother's age. And then within a few weeks, I mean, this young man aged like before my eyes. And I mean, he was gone in 3.5 months, and it is so frightening to see life just slip away.
And the experience made Karen want to document those lives. Not the deaths, but the lives. We shared a recording she made during that time in a previous episode, and I just felt this week like I needed to revisit that. She told us the story of a guy named Michael Calvert.
I'm wired.
I met Michael Calvert through a friend of a friend.
Did you all get specific questions that you want to ask me?
It was July of 1986, and he invited me up to his apartment.
Maybe we should mic him with a regular mic.
And Judy Wenning, who was my producing partner at the time.
How have you been feeling?
I've been feeling rotten. It's the truth.
He was 27 years old when I met him. He was living in Chelsea.
I don't really know why, but just rotten. And I think maybe it's been as mentally a problem as it has physically, the physical pain and the...
And at that time, I think the thing that was really grounding him, he was a member of the People with AIDS Coalition, which was an advocacy group and a support group for these people who were getting sick. There was so much of a stigma around it. People didn't understand it. And Michael had started giving talks, educating healthcare workers about what this disease was doing.
You know, I showed people my lesions today, a spot that I don't even look at on a regular basis. I don't want to see them. I put on a long sleeve shirt so that I don't see them, not so that other people can't. So it was really odd today for me to uncover them for myself in order to show them to other people.
I mean, Michael was a little self-conscious about what AIDS had done to his appearance.
How did that feel?
I wanted to, you know, ask questions about it, and that was okay, and it didn't bother me a bit.
But he was still very cute and slight build, very thin, and he was Southern. He'd moved to New York when he was 20 years old, and so that's the thing. He was young.
I can show you a beautiful picture of me at age 20.
I like your hair long.
I like my hair long, too.
And he'd come from Gadsden, Alabama, where he'd been a straight-A student.
I smoked pot after school with the kids and told them what to study so they could make, you know, passing grades.
He'd started acting in local theater, and I think he'd been kind of a star in his hometown.
Never had a pimple. And then went to the theater every afternoon, evening, and had this whole other group of friends and wild, mystical, free-spirited type friends, and met a lover and things.
So you didn't live at home?
I did live at home, but I kept my curfew all those nights. My curfew was, because I was smart, because I was honest, my curfew was 1 o'clock. They'd rather me be home before that, but they knew I was in the theater. I mean, I was in the newspaper every 6 weeks. So, I mean, it wasn't like they didn't trust me.
But they also knew you were in a relationship with
him. And they didn't know I was in a relationship with this man.
So when Michael came to New York, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be an actor. And he talks about that moment in New York City as being totally life-changing for him.
I was wild, and it was wonderful, and I was not afraid to experience anything and everything when I first came to New York. But I wasn't disciplined, and I didn't get what I really came here for as acting, and I allowed the discovery part of my life to take over and just to do what I wanted to do.
So to support himself, Michael had developed a flower business, which you would, you know, be walking down a street in the West Village and these little outrageously beautiful flower shops had appeared, and it was, you know, orchids and bird of paradise and stuff that just in New York City at that time, which was pretty run down, it was just a gorgeous contrast.
The sad part is, well, there's so many sad parts, but the flower design business was just taking off. And I mean by taking off, I mean he was getting some big clients, and it was becoming finally lucrative.
So that's Rick Kitzman. And Karen, I gotta say, I'm really glad you invited me to join you when you met him, because, you know, having heard all these recordings of Michael from 3 decades ago, I was really longing to meet somebody who was close to him.
Yeah, Rick came to New York City in the late 70s from Colorado, and they met through mutual friends and started dating.
When you said we want to ask about Michael Calvert, I mean, when I read that, bam, all of these emotions just came. It was so out of the blue. And I was just overcome for like 5 seconds of all these thoughts and feelings and emotions, just thinking about, you know, Michael Calvert that came up from that time.
Can you tell us a little bit about him, how you knew him?
Well, it was about 83, 84. My roommate, Sarah Myers, and I threw a party called the Well-Read Party. So not only did everybody wear red, but it was also about reading books. So, you know, it was one of those clever, witty New York things you did in the 80s. And Michael came, and we just hit it off. I mean, he was adorably cute. And he was funnier than hell. And, you know, I grew to just love that Southern charm. But I remember the Well-Read Party. We invited practically everybody we knew, and Michael did the flowers. And what I remember so distinctly was he brought as many red flowers as he could find. Yeah. And so that little apartment was just covered with bouquets of red flowers. And so we wanted a boutonniere for me, and we wanted a corsage for Sarah. And there's no such thing as a red orchid. The closest is a deep orange. And so that was her corsage. And then he was done putting up all the flowers. And I'm going, well, what about me? Where's my boutonniere? And so he said, oh, I didn't forget you. And so he took an anthurium. And those are those, well, we call them the little boy flowers, because they have blood red, more or less, leaves with a stamen of about an inch and a half long of bright gold yellow. And he took one of those and he cut it into a triangle and pinned it to my shirt. And that was my corsage. And I just thought it was so amazingly creative. You know, Michael and I, we just had a good time with each other. And the flip side was it became really a time of grief and fear and eventually rage. This friend got sick. I would hear about this friend who got sick. And the situation for me became just untenable. And so it was in 85 that I decided I just had to leave New York because I knew something really bad was going to happen to me. I remember the last time I'm almost positive it's the last time I saw Michael. And I think he was taking me to LaGuardia. And we were in his van and he had, you know, the back was filled with flowers. And as I recall, he wished I would stay, but, you know, he understood. And I remember he talked about this client and that client and this party and that party. And, you know, you could tell there was this joy of what he was doing because he found something. You know, it may not have been the reason he moved to New York, but that he loved doing and that he was becoming successful doing. And I think for Michael, that was a new achievement. And, you know, it was just really fun to be a part of that and to hear his enthusiasm, you know, contrasted with the sadness of leaving each other. And, you know, I think part of that sadness was I think on some level, it's possible we knew that we wouldn't see each other again.
Is the tape going? Because I want to say this. I did have a good time when I first came to New York, and I'm still having a good time. And I really love my life. You know, and I think that makes me a special person because I don't think there are a lot of people in this world that do. And, you know, the good times have not stopped just because I hurt. And it's really important for me to try to share that with people and to try to help them understand that you can get through difficulty and still have a wonderful, beautiful life.
So what did ultimately happen with Michael and his health?
So, you know, Judy and I met Michael about a year after he was diagnosed. So he had had a little bit of time to come to terms with what was happening to him. But he was getting weaker and I think sicker.
I guess the main problem is just the pain. I mean, I try to describe it in therapy. This is more like heartache pain. I mean, that kind of pain. Pain that's all over, that's undescribable, that's, you can't put your finger on it. It just hurts all over.
Another really terrible thing about that time was that some of these young men were shunned by their families. Their parents cut them off. They wouldn't talk to them.
You told your mother on the phone.
I told my mother on the phone. I had to call her at work. She didn't have a phone.
But Michael actually had a good relationship with his parents and his siblings.
They loved me anyway, without any question, without any hesitation. And I think that meant more than anything. They didn't have to say it. I could tell, you know. I was there. I was with them. The instant I told them. I mean, the telephone doesn't keep people apart. It doesn't separate people, and it really brings people together. And I think that even though it was on the phone, you know, that I told my mother, she loved me anyway. I mean,
well, your family really cares about you, it sounds.
Oh yeah, I'm very, very lucky in that sense. They're not hiding away. I think they're struggling to stay away in as much as I want them to.
But he wanted to be independent. He wanted to continue to take care of himself and live his life. And I hear how much he was struggling with the idea of his decline.
I mean, people poke and prod, and especially mentally, not necessarily physically, but they want to know. They want to, you know, well, how can I help you? I'll do anything. You just call me. Just call me. Now, whose need is that? It ain't mine.
So you want to stay independent how long?
Forever. I mean, just like you, I would think. You know, everybody wants to be free. I don't want to be dependent on anyone. And, you know, and I'm liable to die before I get the chance to express a lot of what's inside of me.
I mean, you know, he was 27 years old. He was really just trying to maintain his equilibrium.
You know, I've thought about this a lot, too, as a gay man who came of age just after Michael's generation, you know, is a lot of men his age, they're almost like first generation that show up in a place like New York and San Francisco and Washington, D.C., from wherever they had come. And they had to do so much to create their lives in those places. They literally created the gay world in which I now live. They made space for themselves, and they were just getting that space. It was just coming into fruition. And just when he's got it, to be faced with something like this.
I'm not crazy about the fact that I have AIDS. It's difficult, and it's a real burden. It's a burden because there's a certain responsibility to helping other people through it, because it's such a difficult thing. It's a burden because it hurts. And I also don't think that this is necessarily going to kill me before, you know, my time. I mean, it may and it may not. And I'm doing everything I can so that it doesn't. That's part of the burden.
When I met him in 86, he swung between feeling very down to believing that he was gonna be a survivor. Mm. And of course, there was a quest at that time mm-hmm. to find a cure.
I fortunately don't think that I'm gonna be in captivity forever. There's probably something on the way. And you know, I still feel like I'll beat the odds. I mean, they say 18 months, I say 19, they say 20, and I say, oh, I'm 24. I mean, I don't care what they say. You know, I know how I feel. This has been a year, and you know, and I feel like I got at least another good year in me, and by that time something should happen that'll help me get through another year, and by that time a cure, and by that time. I mean, it's how I really think. It's how I really, really, really think. Is that denial? Is that stupid? Is that not recognizing the reality? No, because I do know the reality.
I just hear such confidence and optimism in the face of this diagnosis, in the face of this disease that I now know, you know, would kill so many people.
Yeah.
Whatever statistics you quote, I'm going to beat. I'm going to be the person that changes those statistics. I can tell you that right now. I mean, no way am I just living 18 more months.
One of the things that taking this tape, listening to it 34 years later, it's partly just the act of remembering and the act of saying that this man walked the streets and contributed to the life of our city. And Michael died about 5 months after we recorded him. You know, he died too young, but that's something we can do, is remember.
Just so. About out of tape. Oh. So, you know what I want you to do is just be quiet for a while until it runs out.
Oh.
This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll talk to you next week. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Special thanks this week to Christopher Wirth, who produced the original version of this segment. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, Kusha Navadar, Rahima Nassa, and Jared Paul. You can catch the live show on Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern by going to WNYC's YouTube channel, or just stream it at WNYC.org. And listen, if you hear anything that sparks a thought or a question or a story or anything, please do tell us. Send us an email to anxiety@WNYC.org. Bonus points if you send a voice note. I'm Kai Wright. You can find me on both Instagram and Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thanks for listening.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.